You're listening to Buildipedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Buildipedia. Joining us today is James McIntosh from Luti Consulting. And just a little bit of background about James. He's a professional consultant. He's got many, many degrees and has done a lot of study, but his expertise is transport and property consulting. So James, welcome.
Thank you.
One thing I've noticed, James, about your CV is you've done a lot of different things. How important is that in the job that you're doing now in terms of creating reports?
Yeah, look, I've got a varied background. My first degree was in surveying, and I worked as a surveyor for a decade, and then I decided to change and went back and studied sort of transport economics at Sydney Uni, and then wound up doing a PhD with a guy called Peter Newman and how integrated land use and transport planning and economics could tie together. But yeah, I've worked in consulting for 25 years, and one of the interesting things is how you see things change. So as a surveyor, as a junior surveyor, I actually put some of the first pegs in the ground at Kellyville, and they've since ripped those houses up and put a metro station there. So you actually see things change quite dramatically over time. But yeah, I think our company and my history has been really about the interplay between different professional and academic positions, whether it be transport professionals or economics or land use forecasting or property development. I've worked in this space for a long time, and you realize the more that you work with different clients and different circumstances that it is the interface between the different disciplines that is the really interesting piece of work rather than discreetly fixing singular problems.
Yeah, and we talked about that before the episode because you mentioned that, I mentioned to you that my frustration with a lot of the discussion is how vanilla flavored, I called it vanilla flavored. And I get this in the podcast as well, where I speak to someone from a particular, representing a particular group, and their job is to promote that group. And as to whether they fully believe it or not, they're really making it seem like there's nothing else out there except for that thing as a solution. But yeah, it's very nuanced and complicated. And I wonder, is it more complicated today than it was when you put those pegs in at Kellyville? Or is it the fact that I know a lot more about it and it feels complicated? Has it become more complicated over time?
I think it's a really good point. I mean, Sydney, from when I first moved to Sydney in the early 90s to now, about 1.7 to nearly 2 million people have moved to Sydney over that time. So Sydney's not the same place that it was in the early 90s when I first moved there. And I think the issues with regard to infill versus greenfield and transport accessibility versus greenfield amenity, a lot of those discussions and people's, and we'll come back to this term ongoing, is people's willingness to pay has changed quite dramatically. And so Sydney in particular, if we just talk about Sydney as a town, it has changed really quite dramatically in terms of its spatial extents since its inception. I'm actually reading The Fatal Shore at the moment, and it's one of these things about the founding of Sydney, and they talk about places that are there and that were important back in the day and now are, you know, in the suburbs. But from when I first started working in Sydney in the 90s, it has expanded spatially quite a lot. But the biggest difference happened after about 2000 to 2004, and you see this in the census, is demand for infill growth changed pivotally at that point.
So talk us through what that means, demand for infill growth being like apartments. Is it that specific?
Yeah, urban consolidation. Yeah, so a lot of inner urban manufacturing started getting forced out. So you saw things like Alexandria and Zetland and Green Square and Mascot and places. So you saw the conversion of a lot of industrial land over to residential. But I think probably more importantly, the externalities of life in places like Sydney, particularly around the performance of the transport network, had started to exacerbate people's time and the amount of money that they were spending on commuting in particular. So you saw people's choices change and their willingness to pay and the trade-offs that they made with regard to their housing and land use choices, such that the infill markets in Sydney changed dramatically. So you saw a huge increase in demand for inner city living and apartments. So you look, since the year 2000, the amount of density that has started to occur there, because people say, okay, well, I'll trade off this greenfield new house, say, you know, out in the northwest or southwest growth centres, if you compare them now to an infill apartment. And you say, okay, if I live in an apartment near a train station, I might have like a 10, 15 minute commute or something like that, as opposed, which is, you don't get congestion, you don't get a lot of the other time-based reliability risks. Whereas if you think that if you live in some of the outer suburbs, the commuting times have gone up since the early 90s, have gone up by sort of 50%+. You're living in the same places. And the cost in terms of tolls and time, you know, has meant that, yeah, it's a real trade-off.
Yeah, and I remember having this discussion with I think it was a renderer, and who came to my house in Balmain. And there's no question it's a privilege to live in Balmain or Roselle. But he said, you're lucky, I can't afford to live where you live. And I get curious when people say something like that. And I'm saying, well, where do you live? And how much did you pay for your property? And where do you do your work? And what it like? And I just, by the end of it, I mean, you know, this is a while ago. I was maybe a bit less respectful than I am today. I would have been more respectful of that. But being a young and cocky project manager, I went like, I don't think I can afford to live where you live based on that and how many hours you commute and how much you pay. And because the differential wasn't that great. I lived in a much smaller house. He lived in a much bigger house. And I don't know, remember the numbers, but he might have spent 800 grand or 700 grand and I spent 900 grand at that time when you could still buy property in Balmain for that. So the differential wasn't great. He got a much bigger house further away, but it didn't stack up for me at all. Like, I think that's what you're getting. Financially, people are realizing the hours spent commuting and the hours and the cost of commute and the cost of tolls. And when you add it all up, it actually doesn't add up anymore.
No, and there's a trade-off. And people trade transport and amenity costs versus housing. So a lot of people who live in Sydney have this trade-off cost and say, well, if I'm going to live in an urban area, yes, it's going to be value per square meter is going to be significantly higher than I would see in one of the greenfield, but I'm closer to more high-quality restaurants and urban amenity and my commuting costs are less, whereas if I moved out into one of the, you know, Marsden Park or even Oran Park in the Southwest Growth Centre, I get a large single detached house with a two-car garage for the same cost of what you're experiencing in, you know, in Balmain. But I do think one of the challenges for a lot of people is when they look at housing affordability in particular, they are weighing up all these choices. And so, you know, when I used to live in Sydney, I used to live in Darlington and Redfern and in Newtown.
So in the suburbs.
Like, yeah, you know. And I love living there and I lived in Glebe and it was wonderful. But if I look now at the housing choices that I have available to me now with, you know, with teenage kids and all sorts of other things, could I have the same level of amenity with two hulking, you know, 6 foot two, 6 foot four teenagers cruising around the house in the place that I lived when I did in Glebe? The answer is no. So people at different points in life choose different things, and these are trade-offs. But the interesting thing post-COVID, I think for me, which is one of the things that we're starting to model these days, is people's choice with regard to work, you know, the percentage of the week where people work from home. And your renderer mate, it's very hard for him to go through and do a Microsoft Teams call to his client when he's supposed to be stuck on the outside rubbing, you know, some form of cement product on the outside of his house. So there are certain segments of the workforces that, you know, some blue-collar work you can't do from home, but there is a lot, and we're seeing large amounts of particularly the public service still working from home 3-4 days a week. And so their commuting costs, and there's trade-offs that we're talking about. I have one of my clients, and I won't say who it is and who they work for, but she used to live in Marrickville and she's now moved west of Katoomba. And she's like, I can sell my apartment or townhouse that I've got in Marrickville and get a large house with land. The dogs can run around outside. But she can do that because she's working from home 4 days a week. And we're still in the honeymoon period around this. And we don't really understand what the flow-on implications are. And if we ever will go back to a full in-office CBD or centres-based employment model, or whether the working from home, particularly for some sectors.
I'll take it back a step to the reason that I reached out to you. And it was a specific report. The title of it was Transit and Urban Renewal Value Creation. And that's incredibly interesting to me because I didn't find a lot of information in and around. I wanted to understand what the impact of infrastructure, like mass transit, I guess, specifically, but also roads and improvements and other things. I wanted to understand what the relationship is between those new projects coming in and the value of, like, well, my house is a case in point. I've got a metro station being built.
You do.
400, 500 metres away from me.
I did the urban economic appraisal for that metro station at Bays West back in 2018. So I know it very well and have analysed the impact on your property extensively.
So I should have spoken to you before I bought my house. So what broadly can that be answered? Can that be simply answered, or is it a long conversation that we're about to have? Like, is it okay? So taking the metro station in Roselle Bays precinct as a case in point. Now, I'm like, just to add a layer of complexity, I'm in a heritage conservation area, so I'm not in a position, and I'm wondering what part of your report, because your report, correct me if I'm wrong, shows an upside to property value near transport, but does that account for houses and particularly Epping, or whether it's Epping or whether it's Roselle? There's heritage conservation areas where then you're not going to be able to sell your large, small or medium property to a developer for $10 million. Like your house, for all intents and purposes, is going to be still a house. You may be able to develop it somewhat. You may be able to add a room to it or improve it, but it's not going to be a block of apartments, unless there's something you know that I don't.
And it's interesting. So we conduct statistical modelling of the impact of a whole range of urban attributes on land value. And when we do this, we control for, and it's done at an individual lot level. So we have roughly 1 million land parcels in our model across metropolitan Sydney. And then we look at all the urban attributes that are there, distance to the water, distance to centres, CBD, lot size, whether it's strated, whether it's heritage listed, proximity to motorways, proximity to rail, other public transport. And what we can see is we individually control for redevelopment potential in terms of the zone and FSR controls and the impact of changes in accessibility. In the case, if we use your property as an example, there is limited redevelopment potential in Balmain because it is in the heritage precinct and there are quite stringent controls on what you can actually do. But you are getting a really massive change in accessibility. So when I used to live in Sydney and live in Newtown, I used to work in Drummoyne. And that was before the Anzac Bridge. So I used to walk across the Glebe Island Bridge or up on Victoria Road or drive. And quite often, if the traffic was bad, it was quicker to walk from Newtown to Drummoyne than it was to drive.
But just to give people context, because I remember as a kid, when you drove to the city, you went over the old Glebe Island Bridge, which is still there, and occasionally it would open and traffic would stop. So one of your arterial roads into Sydney would stop, the same way the Spit Bridge still opens occasionally, not in peak hour. But yeah, I remember being parked.
Well, Military Road goes to a standstill as Victoria Road used to.
Yeah.
I suppose the point I'm making here is that there are dramatic increases in accessibility in response to Metro. And to all nodes, whether regions that experience changes in like getting a new motorway to an area, it's a much more dispersed impact over a whole region, but it changes the travel time and accessibility for areas. But having worked on the metros for the best part of 10 years and in revealed preference at actually seeing how people spend their money in response to the metros, we can see over time there's been a really marketed increase in willingness to pay for people to go through and locate next to some of the metro lines. So if we look at the extension from Epping out to Tallawong, the intervention there has led to about, if you're within 800 metres of a station there, it's led to an uplift of about 60% in property values. And that's controlling for redevelopment potential and other things.
So when you say controlling for redevelopment potential, it's the properties that are not redeveloped that have gone up in price?
Well, we control for the FSR and we control for the zone in there. So where we actually start to see when we look at places like Epping to Chatswood and the next or the segments as we go into the city, you do see, and when we control for it, so it makes sure that you control for heritage. So it's not including heritage potential. But it is an interesting thing that the closer we get to the city, we do see the willingness to pay for location in these areas change really, really quite dramatically. So when we get into Epping to Chatswood and then Victoria Cross and Crow's Nest, you actually see an accessibility impact there of properties within 400 to 800 metres of these stations going up by 100% compared to the rest of the sub-region around them. And for those who have travelled on Metro, it is an amazing and unique experience. And when the full network out to Sydenham and Sydney Metro West and all these other ones are all in there, it will transform Sydney for the next 100 years. Because if you're on the North Shore and you want to come into the city, you go and jump on the Metro and come, rather than it taking, you know, to get from, say, St. Leonard's, when I used to work out there into the city, you know, trundling around, even if you took the train, I mean, it's so much quicker and easier and much more accessible now, given the service frequencies, to travel from, you know, Crow's Nest into the CBD on Metro than it is to take the heavy rail. So what we're seeing is this difference in travel time is, changes people's locational decisions. So when we look at your property, for you to get to Martin Place, assuming that you drove, A, I'm not sure why you would do it, but B, you wouldn't get a park in Martin Place anyway. But you're going to be 5 minutes from Martin Place when Metro West opens.
Yeah, at the moment, Uber's probably if you want to be in Martin Place, I guess you get a bus that's probably 10 hit miss as to whether they, you know, sometimes they come on time, sometimes they all come together. But so it's probably 20 minutes if from door to door.
But then what we'll see over time is as Sydney reshapes around this, what we've seen, the impacts of Parramatta, the connection between Parramatta and the Sydney CBD, it's effectively going to halve the travel time between Parramatta and the Sydney CBD. And then you've got Sydney Olympic Park in the middle of this. So it will actually really transform that whole region in terms of access to employment. But for your property, some of the forecasts that we've seen in terms of how the market's moving, it's likely that demand for people to locate there, you are literally 5 minutes from the CBD. So prices there could change somewhere between 30 and 50% in the near term.
So what's the timing of that change? Because what I've observed anecdotally is that people don't really get it until they're sitting on it, like the metro, that is. They don't really understand. And I'm guilty of that too, in an indirect way, because it clicked with me the other day that it's not the metro or the tram. It's actually the connection of the two. And I realized that when I had an appointment in Randwick and the drive was 30 minutes, but the public transport travel time was 40 minutes. And I'm like, hang on, that's curious. And it was the connection of the bus from Roselle meeting the tram that went straight to Randwick. And I was like, well, why would you drive and get stuck in the Eastern Distributor, one of the least favorite road experiences in Sydney, I would suggest, and then have to go cut across the Anzac Parade to get to Randwick when you can just get the tram. And I was like, oh, I get it. It's not the tram. It's not the metro. It's the connectivity to take, because before the tram, there's no way I would have got a bus and another bus. Like I wouldn't have done it. I would have driven. So I kind of clicked. And so I guess my question is, do people have to use it to actually appreciate it and value it?
Well, it's a really interesting point, because prior to probably about 2012, the previous Labor government had started and cancelled that many projects that people's belief that it was actually going to occur was close to zero. So with the first metro line, we didn't really see a change in willingness to pay almost until like it was nearly open. But since the delivery and the ability for the market's confidence to say once it's received funding commitment and is commenced construction, that it is going to be delivered, we actually see that's when the monetization or the demand increases basically from commencement of construction. So you see a pretty dramatic increase in the market's response, be it whether it's developers looking for sites or residents moving into an area saying, I'm going to move in there now because in 5 years' time, there's going to be an amazing new transport project and I'm not going to be able to get in there at that point. So we see the monetization at that time. And if you look at projects, it's usually about by the time of commencement of operations, you see 80% or more of the land value uplift occurring at that time. What you do see, though, is subsequent investments or expansions of the network actually have implications for the previous stages. And we've really seen this with the impact on Epping to Chatswood from the connection from Chatswood through to the Martin Place, through to Central. We've seen a huge increase then on the existing line of the expansion of the network. So Sydney siders and a lot of people out there, you know, people in Melbourne have seen projects get announced then canned. I think surety of delivery and New South Wales's history of actually over the last 10 years of securing funding and delivering these projects has given huge confidence to the rest of the market. And, you know, hats off to the New South Wales government for really delivering once in a lifetime or once in a generation transport projects around things like Sydney Metro, things like the light rail network and, you know, Parramatta Light Rail and other projects like that, that are transforming people's lives and reshaping the city around them. And so, yeah, I think New South Wales government has put their money where their mouth is and actually delivered things so that the people that are in Sydney and the people moving to Sydney have confidence that if it's announced, it's started delivery, then it will be delivered and the outcomes will be really positive.
Yeah, but there's nonetheless, do you think there is a lag between like in property, like what's that curve look like in terms, because I, on one of your slides, I saw a lag in terms of property uplift from announcement to construction and then there was an uplift, a lag in uplift.
Yeah, look, there definitely is. I think one of the things is that from commencement of construction through to commencement of operations, you usually see a really pretty pronounced ramping period like that. But as the closer you get to commencement of operations and things become surer, then you actually see some pretty substantial increases in value. So if you look at Crows Nest and Victoria Cross, for instance, two station catchments there, when the whole program sort of started in 2014, and from that point, the regional catchment values versus those station catchments was broadly or roughly about the same value per square meter of land. But then out to when Metro Northwest commenced operations and we saw the other stations, the value uplift at that point around the Victoria Cross and Crows Nest had increased in anticipation of their opening by sort of 40 to 50%. maximum value per square meter within the 400 meter catchments. And then at opening, it had expanded value per square meter for mixed use and residential property in those areas. It had actually expanded out to nearly 100% uplift from the initial estimate.
So as a property investor, you're during that construction period is not a bad time to invest.
That's the time. Because once after that point, after you've commenced operations, broadly, all the benefits have been monetized and you're buying at the peak of the market. So what you actually see is investors and people who want to have that trade-off and have that accessibility benefit of being within a five-minute walk of a metro station and then actually being at Crow's Nest, whatever it is, 15 minutes to the CBD. I mean, that's unheard of. So once the rail's operational, you know, it starts at 4 minutes headway, but the full operation's there. It can and is forecast to basically have 2 minute headway or 30 trains per hour coming through there. So you literally will be living in, it's like picking Crow's Nest up and moving it to North Sydney or even closer to the city. So it's this trade-off between distance to activity centres and in terms of time and the land value. So what you're really seeing is people trading off their travel times or their accessibility with, you know, their location choices.
So the metro is part of the picture though, and because the government's focused on transport-oriented development and rezoning. So what's the interplay between those factors? And I mean, I live in a great sort of case study as well, because we're also in the middle of, we're in the epicenter of motorway construction in, I don't know, probably the southern hemisphere. So we've got this funny time where I live in Rozelle. Rozelle as a suburb has had its brand tarnished because of the opening of the freeway, which caused congestion, which was then blown out of all proportion by the media to a point where we had family from Adelaide ringing us to check on us to see if they needed to send food because we were obviously trapped in Rozelle. So it got, which to me says it's blown out of all proportion.
Oh, look, I think one of the challenges the Rozelle Interchange highlighted was that obviously the second harbour crossing needed to be done and it was the Victoria Road Interchange and all the rest of it. It's part of a network that's yet to be completed. So there are always staging impacts and other things like that. So I don't want to be too hard on the successive governments who've made the decision to do that.
Yeah, but nonetheless, the brand was like Rozelle as a suburb was like the Rozelle Interchange. We should rebrand it to the something else interchange.
I mean, I think there's been multiple, whether it's the brand impact on Rozelle or probably more importantly, the brand impact of the investment in WestConnex and what that means for Sydney. I think that's once a bit like the metro network. Everyone loves metro now that it's operational, but the construction impacts and everything else has been horrific. So everyone's like, oh God, bloody metro, all this sort of stuff. But now it's operational. Everyone's like, oh, this is the best thing that's ever happened to Sydney.
Or the light rail, which is incredibly disruptive and yet now transformative, but you know, unfortunately killed a lot of businesses in its construction.
And look, there was some compensation paid with the light rail as well, but I think there's also been a really substantial uplift in the subsequent markets on the eastern suburbs light rail, and we've done some modelling of that. And it's sort of, depending on where you are, it goes up by sort of 15 to 20% now, but the construction impacts were really bad. What I would say with regard to Rozelle and WestConnex is that once the network's performing at its fullest potential, yes, I think a lot of the short-term brand implications for Rozelle will be.
Oh, look, I'm not by no means worried. I guess I'm curious to understand how in Rozelle we've got the trifecta. We've got the Bays Precinct, which is a huge new population area. If we've got, I guess, the Rozelle Interchange and the Metro all layered on top, I guess potentially Victoria Road renewal, and I mean I haven't researched it, but it seemed like government was tight-lipped. But everyone knows that something's going to change with Victoria Road.
Likely to be a pretty significant, a bit like Military Road, you'll have a pretty significant busway service and some other things.
Yeah. Or maybe like Epping Road is a good good example where it's down to one lane of traffic and it's rationalized into good cycleways and it doesn't feel like a busy road anymore. But yeah, what about the impact of all the people moving in? Like, because for some people, obviously that's going to be unbearable because they've lived in a quiet, they like the quietness of having this village feel. And suddenly, I don't remember how many thousand people are going to be potentially moving in to the Bay's precinct, but it's a disruption. For me, I think it's a great disruption, but how many people are positive in Rozelle, in the adjoining area, how many people are positive and what is the interplay between property value and a major new population centre?
Look, I think, and if we talk about Bays, I mean, Bays is obviously the renewal of the White Bay Power Station precinct, and it's an urban renewal project that is adjacent to Balmain. I think the uplift on Balmain with respect to the eyesore and the negative activities around the White Bay Power Station and that being renewed and turned into a new urban renewal precinct and it'll become an asset to Balmain rather than it being a blight. When I worked on the Metro West, we actually monetized the impact of the renewal on that of being adjacent to it. So there's roughly between a 10 and 15% uplift on the surrounding property values for the renewal of that site of not being near urban blight. But it's not, I think, the improved accessibility, positive improved accessibility impacts on Balmain and that region are, you know, in terms of access to the, you know, the metro and access into the CBD, but also the removal of urban blight. I think the positive implications are enormous for that region and the existing people that live there. But the other part of this is that there will be additional population through the mixed use precincts that are being proposed down there. And yeah, some of those people might go up into Balmain. One of my friend's father owns a fantastic pizza shop up there, the Tipo 00. And if I lived anywhere near there, I'd be going up there for pizza every second day. But yes, there will be more people adjacent rather than you living next door to an industrial eyesore. So I think there are pros and cons of all of it. But as in all things in Sydney, as people move there, Sydney gets reshaped over time. So they're not bulldozing Balmain, but they're cleaning up what's next to it. And there's an interplay between the urban renewal precinct and the historic area.
Yeah, so I think I share that sentiment. I mean, we need that transport-oriented development. And I think populations next to mass transit rather than greenfield is hugely preferable and better. And you look at all the great cities that people want to visit, they have population density and lots of interesting things happening. But I guess I had a question about, I wanted to go back to your report and generally, because I understand your reports are done for government. And like, I don't want to delve into any confidentiality, but why do governments commission you to do reports on property value? Why is that something that government's interested in?
So the ones that we have up online, we're not commissioned by anyone. We've done of our own volition. So we've conducted this analysis for most Australian states. We have put the ones up for Sydney since 2014. So we have multiple copies of our report there. A lot of the time when we do work for government, it is in business cases for transport investments to actually understand the implications for increased urban efficiency and urban economic benefit to New South Wales for unlocking transformative growth around and reshaping Sydney in particular around transport investments. So in particular, there are what these investments in, and let's just stick with Metro for a second, you have increases in accessibility and speed. So access and travel to places like the Sydney CBD, it transforms that. But the actual carrying capacity of the line is enormous too. So in its current form, it can move about 45,000 people an hour. So that's 45,000 people not on the road network or on buses or everything. So it's what we would call a low externality or low transport externality mode that enables vast amounts of people to access this mode and access different centres without filling it with cars and without us needing to fill all the centres with more car parking to support vehicle-based access. So when we talk about different transport modes, metro being a great example, it's not dramatically faster than other modes, than other, like the heavy rail network. It's not a lot faster than that, though it is. But the real benefit is because it's automated and a very high frequency, it actually carries an enormous amount of people. So you look at the differences in the precincts, and this takes time because obviously you don't get instantaneous development around them, but you're starting to see metro now at 4-minute headways coming into the AM peak into Sydney starting to be getting up to 80 to 90% capacity. So 100% capacity in 4-minute headways moves about 45,000 people now.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, but they have the ability to double the service frequency on that, to take it from, you know, 15 trains an hour to 30 trains an hour. So they can actually increase their up to 60 to 70,000 people an hour to move up and down into employment. So you imagine the amount of people that, and we've got to think about Sydney not in terms of the lucky people like yourself that live there today. It's about 100,000 people per year that move to Sydney. Where are they going to live and how are we going to move them efficiently around Sydney to access work, places to play, places to recreate? How are we going to move people around efficiently in a low cost or a low transport cost environment? Because if everyone drives everywhere, the place is a 24-hour car park.
Absolutely. And even on a Saturday when everyone's driving kids around to sport, it becomes a car park of...
It's massive.
We got to a point where we just quit kids' sport on behalf. We collaborated with the kids and went, we won't tell anyone if you don't, but let's not do this because it's crap. Like just driving 4 kids to different sporting events. It's like, how about we all go somewhere and do something together? Because it was an awful experience and we were stuck in traffic on a Saturday.
That's it. And I have to say, it's interesting that you raise that because it is one of the things in transport now is off-peak and weekend travel is so heavily dominated by car-based travel because if you live in Roselle, for instance, but you may have to go to, I don't know, you might have to go to Campsie for a soccer game and then you might have to go over to Epping for a netball game and then you might have to go here and here and here. The only way to do those trips is by car.
The only way, otherwise it's that you won't actually make it to the game. there was no other way and we were tight on top because, yeah, we were going from Marrickville area to from Balmain to Concord and there was absolutely zero chance. And that's why we just said, how about we won't do it for a year because this is exhausting.
But I think it's one of the really interesting things that as a society, we need to think more broadly around the role of, and we're starting to do this more, is the role of parks and urban amenity in different areas and not just having singular areas for, sporting facilities and things, is that the access, the people now value quite significantly access to urban parkland and urban open space and everything else to go and play kids' sport because precisely that, what we're seeing now is you do have these dense urban areas, Wentworth Point being a classic example of this, of very, very little public open space. So access to public open space for families is now starting to become a massive priority. So areas that are transport rich with areas of high open space and urban amenity in that regard, we're seeing driving even greater levels of people's willingness to pay.
Yeah. So just thinking about your report, so it wasn't commissioned by anyone. You just decided to do it one day. What's the underlying benefit to you of doing that as a something to share? Like, I know you're passionate about property, but surely there's a economic benefit to doing this.
Oh, look, there is. And so when I did my PhD I was supported by Infrastructure Australia when I was doing it, and Michael Deegan, who was set up the analysis group and set up IA at the time, said to me, we need a resource to go through in revealed preference so that people can actually, rather than using stated preference of asking people things, actually in revealed preference how they're spending money. And that was the premise of my PhD to do that. So I got support from them and then initial support from Sydney Metro back in the day to provide data as an input in there so we could actually start analysing it. And yeah, so Transport for New South Wales and Infrastructure Australia supported us to go through and build this data set so that that could be an evidence base, particularly for New South Wales government, but for everyone, property developers, everyone out there who wants to understand the differences in willingness to pay. And me being an urban economist, I thought this thing's going to be amazing and everyone's going to use it. And I presented it at the Reserve Bank, I think it was about 2015, to the Economic Society of Australia. And one of the people said, it's just too complicated for people to get their head around. And I'm like, shit, if economists from the Reserve Bank are finding this complicated, what hope do I have? So we've tried to simplify it in terms of direct impacts on property and things. But we're going back to the siloed nature of different professions. I think because this crosses the boundaries between transport economics, urban willingness to pay for different attributes, and the property sector, that we actually see the property sector talking specifically about, you know, feasibility and underlying land values and some of the urban amenity without actually understanding and being able to monetize the impacts of transport projects. So it becomes these ancillary benefits. So we did it from a consulting perspective to provide an evidence base. And it's been open and free for everyone to use. The first one went up about 10 years ago. We did an update about 5 years ago. And we're going to do another update shortly. But we're trying to progress people's thinking. The benefit to us is that urban economics starts to become more of a consideration for government investments around a whole range of things. So we worked on Macquarie Park Innovation Precinct and how they were going to reshape parts of Macquarie Park and Central Station. We've also done a whole series of different things around flood resilience and flood evacuation and how these things can drive that. So it's a useful tool for everyone, but it was initially prepared and has been an ongoing resource for the intention that everyone can get access and start to understand it.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, there's a lot there to get through. I got my notebook language model to help me analyze and answer a few questions. But I guess it is it's a substantial work. And yeah, I mean, you ought to be commended on creating this report and making it readily available. It's certainly the only thing I found that answered a lot of the questions I had about property value. But I guess my question is, what did you find when you were undertaking the work that just followed what you expected, and what were the things that surprised you?
Look, when we first built one of these models was, again, my business partner and I, Roman Trubka, we were doing our PhDs in Western Australia and we built the first model in WA. And one of the really surprising things was how, and it's intuitive, but actually monetizing the things that people don't like. And this was probably one of the emergent issues that we started to, and we were one of the first ever, well, particularly in Australia, but almost globally, to monetize the impact of traffic noise on people's, you know, property values. So motorways without sound walls had a negative impact up to about 20 to 25% on adjacent properties. With sound walls, that sort of halved. And then the further away that you got, that the dissipation of noise. So we created an index around decibel, and it's on an exponential curve, but basically there's a series of decibel thresholds that people just hate. And when I lived in Sydney, at one point I lived on Cleveland Street, which in a terrace house in Cleveland Street, because I was a struggling student. And I remember living there and it was cheaper than everywhere else. And I moved in there thinking, oh, this isn't so bad. And then it sort of about 2 o'clock on a Sunday night, all the trucks come rumbling down the hill on Cleveland Street. I'm like, now I know why it was so noisy. And I remember thinking, it's like, oh, this is hideous. But you can actually monetize that. So the rents at the time were about 15% cheaper living on Cleveland Street than living two blocks back. So we actually monetized all the things that people didn't like. And then we started to understand what people did like. And different people valued things differently at different times.
Different times of day or different times of their lives? What are we talking about?
Well, different times of the investment. So what you would see, a bit like what we're talking about with Metro, the Australia's fastest rail line is the Mandurah to Perth CBD rail line. It goes 127 kilometres an hour and runs up the median of the Kwinana Freeway. And so what we found in there when we were looking at it, because it was a really famous rail line at the time, still is, it's fantastic. 72 kilometres away in Mandurah, you can get from Mandurah into the Perth CBD in an hour, whereas before that investment, it took 2.5 hours. So amazing piece of equipment. And I think the really interesting thing when we did this is when we first looked at it, all we could see was all the negative aspects, all the people, it was too noisy, people didn't access it in the way that we expect, people weren't walking to it. But when we controlled for everything, what we found is that the rail line had an improvement in land values of about 25%. And yet it wasn't people who lived there. It was the people who used the park and rides and the region around there, the park and ride, because everyone drove to these train stations. So it was understanding, it's really behavioral economics of how people use infrastructure and how that changes their willingness to pay. So it had nothing to do with living or being near the Mandurah line. It was how people valued access. So what we saw is there being a huge uplift in the quantum and value of development in Mandurah at a broader regional level through the access of the park and ride bays at the Mandurah train station. And that willingness to pay happened basically from commencement of operations and onwards. So you saw about a 15 to 20% uplift in value for the area, but you saw the quantum of development that was allowed to occur down there over time is dramatic. So you saw this changing quantum and price, but very few people, if any, had actually understood or been able to monetize who is getting benefit and where and why. So we actually start to do that. So that was probably the biggest learning, was that we could work at what people didn't like. And it was very hard to work out what people did like. And it came down to a behavioral economics.
And how much of it is because, again, the thing I know about behavioral economics is that it kind of goes counter sometimes to the supply and demand and rational economics, right? So what people actually do is different. So I wonder how much of it is just knowing that it's there rather than the tangible benefit. How much of it is actually tangible, like cost, time saving in minutes? And how much of it is just a perception that it's better, because we know that people don't always act rationally. An example of that I or my family and mates point out is I like to have an all-wheel drive car for that one time in every 2 or 3 years that I go to the snow, because it's so much better than snow chains. And I know that it's on a cost-adjusted basis, it doesn't make any sense. And I know that it's a really dumb thing and I should, you know, but I kind of, it's that once in a 3 year time, once in a 2 year time that I like to have an all-wheel drive car. And it's not deep down I know it's not a rational decision, but I like to know it's there when I need it. So I wonder how much of that is embedded in your, or born out in your model, that it's actually the perception of what's around me rather than the tangible benefit.
Yeah, I think that you raise a really interesting point, because when I was at Sydney Uni, one of the lecturers pointed out all models are wrong, but some are useful. And I think it's something that a lot of our modeling isn't the truth, but it provides a really good insight into, at a statistical level, how people behave and what their willingness to pay is. When we look at our models from a predictability or ability to predict future change, the models normally report between 85 and 90% of the variance in property values. So we have a whole range of urban attributes in there, but there's still 10 to 15% that we can't report. So there's your decision matrix for having a large four-wheel drive vehicle versus having a Prius. You know, you probably fall into the noise or fall into the part of our model that we can't explain. But you live in the location in Sydney that you do because of the nice urban environment, which we would pick up through what we call suburb fixed effects in our model. We pick up that living in the, you know, the suburb of Balmain or Rozelle compared to the rest of the region has an intrinsic urban value probably of 15 to 20% higher than the rest of the mean because it counts for street trees, it's got nice restaurants, access to the water and all, and we control for all of those things. And there we control for socioeconomics in our models as well, so they're trying to account for a whole bunch of different things there. What is more challenging, I suppose, is aspirationally asking, well, what could Balmain be better? Or, you know, like what does Balmain not have that we could use to forecast a change? Or probably more importantly, rather than talking about Balmain in that context, but talking about this other areas like Camellia or some of the other areas on Metro Line and saying, okay, what if we go through and we put a whole series of investments in some of these areas, what would the change be? Do we need more parkland? Do we need more mixed use? Do we need more access to transport? Do we need, what are the benefits, all the benefits of the things that we think forecasting change in these areas and what could that be? And from a supply side, do we need to go and put in place for that to occur? And what things do we need to put in place such that from people demand there and actually want to go through and live there and take up this opportunity for these new buildings? So there are some things that we can control for, things like we need access to water. So we need Sydney Water to go and put the water in there. We need access to schools. We need, for every 1,000 people, you need, you know, half a dozen or whatever it is, a couple of primary schools and a high school. You need access to parkland. You need access to all these things. And the irony is that if you leave one of the elements out, like you put an urban renewal precinct in somewhere and you don't put any schools, actually people won't go there. Or they'll go there and then start howling about schools and then leave because they've got to go somewhere else because the kids go here.
Yeah, right. So you have to have everything in place. It's a somewhat of a multiplier effect or a reinforcing effect.
So what we've seen in doing work in places like Oran Park in Western Sydney is that forecasting for government's really hard there. So every time they open up a primary school, it's day one, term one, it's full, and they need another two. So, you know, they've got to a point that they're rolling out primary schools every two or three years, and they're full every time they open because of the latent demand for things like primary schools and high schools is massive. And then people start moving to areas because they have brand new primary schools and high schools there. So then you become self-reinforcing.
Yeah, right. So it's like it's like an education induction effect.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also land availability. So we can't go through and put 1,000 people per year in Balmain because you've got nowhere to build them. Whereas out there, there's grass, there's other things out there. So we can roll out significant amounts of housing. We can roll out other schools, parkland, other things that urban amenity that people want.
So we've probably got to wrap up soon, but there's something that we haven't really touched on, which is that the fact that at the moment it seems the consensus is that most development doesn't stack up from a cost of construction, cost of development, cost of compliance and interest rates and everything put together seems to, and hence a housing shortage and the environment and debt that people are carrying and all of that put together seems like a bit of a shit sandwich of things that constrain development. So what's the future of, I mean, is there a chance that the base precinct or those mass rezones aren't going to have much of an effect because developers don't see things stacking up? And I know that from talking to developers, things just aren't stacking up. So what's going to, is an interest rate cut alone going to shift that? Where are we heading? We're developing amazing transport. Are we going to be able to afford to build density around it?
Yeah, look, I think it's a really acute time in the property market. And close friends of mine who work at JLL, Tim Brown and Dan Torini, who run the property economics firm component of Jones Lang LaSalle for Australia, provide some really amazing insights in this space. But you know, you've got generally a flat economy with low productivity growth in there, sort of holding back people's growth in wealth. And you've obviously then got prolonged high interest rates sort of forcing down from the demand side around that enables the growth in apartments and in a living for people to go through and pay. And then you've got the delivery cost sales, the costs around pre-sale requirements, cost, obviously everyone's well known about the cost of construction costs. And then you've also got probably the biggest one is the as-is property values because of housing shortage. The actual as-is values for a site amalgamation, the as-is values are really high. So when developers do their residual land value calculations, they actually have, you know, they're getting it from both ends, is that the costs have gone up, but the willingness to pay for apartments and everything else is either flat or going down or being forced down. So when they do their, you know, site evaluations, these developments are not feasible. So it is a major constraint to urban infill at this point in time. So we need to support the federal government to go through and increase labour productivity in any way that they can. We need to encourage the government to go through and do what they can to put a lid on inflation so the Reserve Bank can go through and reduce interest rates. But there are some silver linings out there, in my view, particularly in New South Wales, around the use of government land and programs like the Communities Plus program that the Land and Housing Corporation run and Housing New South Wales run, is that that's a partnership between the private sector and the public sector to go through and deliver a mix of social and affordable and private housing on government land. There's some great examples, and you can look them up online at Ivanhoe, Riverwood, and, you know, a whole assortment. And basically, I think in the near term for delivery of a broader amount of housing in some of these areas, Communities Plus can certainly deliver that. And I think should be viewed as an option for government at this time to actually start rolling out more supply.
So I guess on low, because that's the real problem, isn't it? Like it's low cost housing. The people who own a house are well off. It's the people who don't own a property that are squeezed from both ends because housing's it's not affordable for them to buy, and they're being squeezed out of rental market. But in every development, there's a fee that you have to pay to get out of providing low cost housing, right? I don't remember what it's called, but has that money that's collected on every development by the government to get out of low cost housing, has that been used effectively, or is that just a tax that goes into the?
Look, I'm not sure how the revenue has been hypothecated, but I can't imagine that they're just going through and putting it into consolidated revenue. I think there's a misnomer around some of these things, that delivery of private sector housing on and higher end high public or private housing is a problem, because anything that adds to supply, whether at the top end, the bottom end, or whatever else, anything that actually adds to supply is positive, because as people move through the property market, you know, if you build higher end apartments, wealthy people in, you know, freestanding houses move into them as they retire. It frees up for other people to move into their house, other people to move into their house, and so on and so on, so forth. But I would frame this also as the net migration into New South Wales, and particularly into Sydney, is really quite substantial. So a lot of what we're proposing here is about how Sydney grows. And even if we subscribe ourselves to Bob Carr's comment, you know, back in the day, Sydney's full, go somewhere else. You know, there are no, you know, macroeconomic levers to go through and achieve that, even if you wanted to. But I think for me, if you recall, Mike Baird turned around and said the greatest threat to New South Wales's economy is actually housing affordability. Because where are our cops, our nurses, our police? Where are they going to live? Where's everyone going to live to maintain the level of service and society that we all expect and we want? And so it's not just a social good, but it's an economic good and an economic right for New South Wales to deliver this. And that's why I'm very firmly of the view that anything that adds to supply, and there are a whole range of supply-side metrics that can be put in place to go through and encourage that, but with the development of Metro, and no offence to people of Rozelle and Balmain, but you need to encourage as many people to support infill development around this, or otherwise they're going to move, everyone who moves to Sydney is going to be stuck in the outer suburbs and they're going to clog Victoria Road even more. So your urban amenity is going to go down dramatically with the impact on the road network if they move into the outer urban areas where there's land availability, as opposed to moving to more transit-oriented areas where people can use the public transport system, particularly metro, to get around in a far more efficient way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And there is a fear, I guess, in the old described as NIMBYism, where change is a negative. And there are some people who just don't want anything to change, full stop. Other people are actually quite fearful that that change will impact the value of their property. So is there a case to be made for, like, educating people, actually, this is good for your prop, like, this development happening here around you, you don't need to, okay, it's going to change your, the street's going to make the street busier, but actually, when all said and done, when you drill really deep, people worry about the value of their property, really, whether they're NIMBYs, YIMBYs, or whoever, that's a real factor. So is it worth promoting the fact that actually the Bays Precinct, for example, the increased density, generally the transport infrastructure, it's actually good for your property value?
Absolutely. And, yeah, I mean, I do get, I mean, Inner West Council has been probably one of the most strongly driven councils against a lot of infill development over the last 10 years. And I understand the lack of willingness to go and turn every site into a 50-story tower. I mean, that's fine. But I do think that there needs to be, where high-value urban infrastructure is provided, be it metro or light rail or other forms of infrastructure, then you can't just be the lucky transit-rich people. You have to do, everyone has to share the development burden such that Sydney works better as a town. And I think whether it's in Sydney or our clients, you know, elsewhere in Queensland or in Auckland or wherever, we've got significant client bases in WA and in South Australia as well. And the story is the same everywhere. But urban renewal, urban change, there is market and demand for this. And I think probably the thing that I would almost say in closing to you is the cost to New South Wales of not realising the potential of the investments that the government is making intergenerationally will be felt, you know, for your children and your children's children, that if the opportunity that is created by these investments is not realised, then the, you know, dead weight loss to the economy of this is enormous. So I'm not saying all development occurs everywhere all the time, but where investments are made and they're made with a targeted approach of actually increasing development around them and consolidating development, it needs to be viewed within the context. If it's not happening here, and specifically if you look at places like Dulwich Hill and Marrickville and Sydenham and some of the other areas on the Sydenham to Bankstown line that's getting metro, if we don't go through and do it there, the growth of Sydney has got to go somewhere. And the externalities on the rest of Sydney will be felt for generations to come.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, to your point, Inner West, I think because we're very much in, we're in the Inner West, I live and work in the Inner West. And I think council in the Inner West as much, it's probably more about dysfunction than it is around, like, I think they're turning the corner and they're changing. Because it was probably the long and the short is probably a planning department with a poor culture hijacked by a few anti-development forces or opposition. Sometimes it's not even anti-development, it's just oppositional forces. So I think that's changing. I think Inner West is moving in the right direction and realizing that this is better. They're certainly, the mayor himself has told us that. But I think, yeah, I think you're spot on. I couldn't agree more. I think it's such a huge opportunity and an incredible, yeah. And you only have to go to other cities to realize what is happening to Sydney is something special. you know, there's something interesting and special and a network of things happening that are the real value. But yeah, absolutely. And I think certainly your reports are fantastic, and I commend you on them, and I really appreciate your time. Like, I appreciate you pulling out time, and we look forward to the next report. And so maybe if we could close out, you can tell listeners where to find your report and what to look for.
Yeah, sure. So if you look up Looting Consulting on the website, on the web, you can go to our webpage and you can go through and download it for free. You can also feel free to contact us through the website in terms of email or through LinkedIn or through the phone. But we are very open to sharing our information if people got any questions or want any additional information with regard to our modelling or our approach. Very happy to share.
Thank you so much, James. Dr. James McIntosh. I should have said Dr. James when I introduced you initially, but thank you so much for your time. Really, it's been a great chat. I think we'll I'd love to have you back another time because there's so many other things to talk about. I really wanted to focus on transport, but because you can, otherwise I'll ramble and take things in different directions. But really appreciate it. And Luti, spelled LUTI Consulting, really great resource. Anyone who's in development needs to check it out and understand it. And it's kind of a little bit under the radar, I think, but it's a hugely important work. Or maybe I was just naive and not, maybe everyone else in development knows about it and just isn't talking about it.
Well, I mean, I do teach it at Urban Economics at UTS, and I have been using it as a resource for them, but I think it is an undervalued resource, and I'm very happy to share it with you.
Thank you, Dr. James McIntosh. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our listeners. To access exclusive content and links to the Luti report, consulting reports, we'll put some links up. Thanks to listeners. Please subscribe. And yeah, a lot more information in our show notes. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Buildipedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildipedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.